Okay, Erev Tov, good evening, everybody. as you can gather, my voice is sort of wavering a little bit, but hopefully we'll manage to get through the shiur. It's difficult. I've got to give a bit of hakdama here, because chapter 7 of the book of Daniel represents a real change in the Sefer. Till now, I mean, it's fair to say, through first six chapters, six prakim, we're dealing with a story. We're dealing with the situation of Daniel and his chaverim in a foreign land, in the land of Babel. Good evening. And how they managed to rise to prominence, etc., with all of the issues of being in government in the non-Jewish world. It's a sefer galut. It's a sefer of exile. It's a sefer certainly, as we've said many times, the sefer of Emuna, the tremendous faith of Daniel in his in the way that he conducts himself is really quite inspiring. No question about that. Chapter 7 through chapter 12, the second half of the book, complete sea change, completely. And the Malbim really sort of spells it out. He says through the first six chapters is the narrative. Chapter 7 through chapter 12 are the prophecies. What happens is that Daniel starts recording, or in fact the tradition is it's actually recorded by the men of the Great Assembly, Shnei Esar Gedolot. They record what Daniel prophesied, and all of these prophecies, I mean, each one gets stranger than the next. Each one is very, very different from the sort of prophecies. If I said to you, as a kind of general rule about prophecy in the Bible, you know, you'll think of Isaiah, you'll think of Jeremiah, you'll think of all those types of prophecies where they're talking about sort of, you know, if they're talking the future of the world, you know, all these types of psukim, which deal with, how should we call it, more concrete types of things, more, I suppose you would say, down to earth, if that's the way to describe it, prophecy. Right, the fall of certain kingdoms, etc. It's expressed in what we call a more realistic way. When we read the book of Daniel, we're going to read prophecy, which is expressed in images which are just too fantastic for words. The images of the book of Daniel, already you'll see in chapter 7, are really above and beyond anything that we've ever seen in any other sefer of Tanakh. And that's number one, what makes it so interesting, but number two, what makes it also so challenging. He talks in, we already saw a bit of this with the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. We saw, you know, the strange images of the monsters that he saw, and he goes back to that. And there is a commentary who makes a comparison between the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and the dream of Daniel. I don't want to go into that. That's something that certainly one can look at in one's own time. What we're going to see here, and again, just to quote from Rav Ariel, the sefer that I've been quoting to you, a teacher in Israel today, I'll just read out very few lines of what he says. Yeshev del gadol ben yom Hashem mafia b'tiri nevi'im. When they talk about the day of God, the future, the Mashiach, in the description of the prophets, meaning the books of Isaiah, etc., lebein zeh shebechazon Daniel. There's a great difference between what they talk about and what Daniel talks about. Hanaviim atarim et hamishpat b'tzva'im realim. The Naviim talk in real colors. All right, everything is kind of a, you know, the world will be what it will be. The lion will lie down with the lamb. You know, all these sort of famous descriptions, right? When it's happening in this world, according to people like Isaiah. According to Daniel, this is a heavenly judgment. Everything about the future will stem from God, from heaven, which will take place in heaven. It will express itself in heaven. And therefore he talks about the angels of the nations. And he talks about images which represent those nations. Everything about Daniel's prophecy is in the realm of the fantastic. As opposed to the realm of the real, of the down to earth, everything is in the sky. Daniel madgish et sofiuto shel adin hazeh. Daniel sort of stresses the the end of this particular judgment, Hachotem et Historia, which completes history, Umufneh Neged Umot Olam Bilvad, and it's directed towards the nations, Yisrael and Chelikbo. That judgment which he's talking about is something, as you'll see already in chapter 7, which is going towards the nations of the world. At the end of days, what Daniel does, he is going to see and prophesy about events which are going to take place in the future. In fact, a lot of the stuff that he talks about, we can relate to. All right, there's a reference here to the end of, interesting thing, we'll see in a minute, he refers to Islam. He makes a reference to things that are going to come about 1,000 years after, you know, his death. He makes a reference to the Catholic Church. There are references, according to some commentaries, to the popes. All right, you know, he's got a very interesting thing, but it's all directed towards Umot Olam, to the nations of the world. What I would suggest also, if you notice, chapter 7 is still in the Aramaic, which is in the what we would call the vernacular. For the nations of the world to listen to this and to understand it, in the days of Daniel, that's the language that everybody spoke. And then in chapter 8 through chapter 12, which are still more prophecies and prayers of Daniel, goes back into Hebrew. And of course, that the suggestion there is that maybe that is more, you know, directed towards his own people, towards Am Yisrael, that we should also hear it, we should internalize it, we should take it to heart, we should not lose hope. A second introduction, which I just want to add, is again something that I just cannot do within the scope of the shir, but I mentioned it, is to look at the commentary of the Malbim. The Malbim, which was written, the commentary around 1850, by this very famous rabbi, Meir Leibish Malbim. The family name was the acrostic of his Hebrew name. And he was a very, very unique rabbi in so many ways, very controversial, very great scholar, also very, very outspoken. Very against the reform, he got himself into a lot of trouble. Eventually, I think he was even arrested on a number of occasions because he was so outspoken against reform, development of Reform Judaism, and all that sort of in that time period. And one of the things that he got himself into trouble with everybody, not just with the reformers, was his commentary in the Book of Daniel. In the end of chapter 7. And what I'll have to do, I'll have to just print out a little section of it to show you. And then at the end of chapter 12, right at the end of the Sefer, he starts using the book of Daniel to predict when Mashiach is coming. He actually starts giving you dates. He talks about the year 1868. Tav Resh Kaf Chet. Had to work it out. Sit down and work it out. He talks about the year 60 years after that, 1920. I'm not sure what these dates were. And you'll see, even from chapter 7, we already get this sense that there is a time frame for the galut, the exile, which is taking place after the Jews are exiled on the second occasion from Eretz Israel, which is also being referred to here. It's already predicted that there will be an exile, and it will last for a certain number, 1,000 plus years, or almost 2,000 years, as far as we're concerned. And again, all of the dates that he writes down, they're very interesting. They've all passed by. We don't, and none of those dates became messianic, as we can testify we're still around. Mashiach has not yet come, but it's fascinating that the Malbim attempted to do this, to make calculations based on the book of Daniel, dates, Hebrew dates, of years which were potentially years of messianic arrival. All right, and again, the Vilna Gaon also indulged in this a little bit. He talks about the year 1840. The Vilna Gaon died at the time of the French Revolution. So he died in 1797, I think it was. And he talks about the year 1840 as being a year of incredible messianic potential. And in fact, the year 1840 became the year when the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, along with the Chovei Tzion, you know, the early Zionist movements, the religious movements of those days, started the new Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. They went to these very difficult places and started from scratch. So there have been attempts by different rabbis to try to put some sort of real number onto what we're going to be learning here. But the majority of opinions, and as I said, the Malbim got himself into a lot of controversial discussion about it. A lot of people rejected the whole commentary because of what he wrote about that. which again was one of those things that, as I said, did the book a lot of good, because then everybody bought the book because they wanted to read it. And, you know, the Malbim was someone who's prepared to stick his neck out. And on this occasion, certainly when it comes to predicting the messianic dates, he also stuck his neck out in a big way. So that's another thing that we'll have to sort of be aware of as we go through chapter 7 through to chapter 12. Okay, so again, the difference in the style of prophecy, and also the fact that there are many rabbis who use this particular book of Daniel, part of the book of Daniel, to predict future messianic predictions, which already started in the days of Rambam and earlier, but is famous, as I said, by the Malbim, and to a lesser extent, the Vilna Gaon as well. Okay, so on that basis, let's have a look at chapter 7. I think it's page Nun, isn't it? Page 50? Yeah, Nun. And listen to this. And as I said, this is about as bizarre as it gets. Bishnat Chada leBelshazzar Melech Babel. So we're going back. Remember, last week we read about the end of Belshazzar. In fact, three weeks ago, which was the meal of Belshazzar, you know, and that night he was assassinated. It turns out that he was king, in fact, for 3 years. So the story we read in chapter 5 was the end of the third year of his kingdom. We're now recording the first of Daniel's prophecies, which took place in the first year of Belshazzar's kingdom. Who was Belshazzar? Again, some say he was the son of Nebuchadnezzar, some say he was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Basically, someone who was in the Babylonian hierarchy of his day. He was the king of Babylon, or the emperor, or whatever. So, Bishnat Chada leBelshazzar Melech Bavel. It was in the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Bavel. Daniel Chelem Chazar. Daniel saw a dream. The Chesvei Reisha Mishkevei. And what happened was that he saw this while he was on his bed. All right, this was a prophecy. And again, the Rambam talks about prophecy in terms of how it was an experience. And according to Rambam, prophecy was always experienced indirectly. All right, except for Moshe Rabbeinu, it was a special case. But usually it was done through a dream, through some sort of trance, something like that. That was the style of prophecy in Tanakh. And Daniel also, he says he's had this prophecy, but he was lying down. Ba'adayin chelma ketav, reish milin amar. So what did he do? When he saw the dream, he wrote down the reish milin. In other words, he wrote down the outline of it. He didn't write down all the details. And what we're going to read is the rabbis say that what he wrote down for people to read with the outline, but I think the tradition is that this has been filled in. As I said, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah gave us the interpretation. As you'll see later on, there's a lot of discussion about what it means in the chapter. We'll come to all of this in a few minutes. Bet. So, Anei Daniel Vama. So, Daniel starts with the following statement. He says, Chazei Chaveit Bechezveim Leila. I saw this image at night. This is where it gets weird. Va'aru Arba Ruchei Shemaya. And he says there were four winds of the heaven. Okay? Magichan liyama rabba, that they were stirring, they were making a tremendous. If you ever seen the movie, what was that film? The Perfect Storm. I always think of that film when they on the boats and they had this incredible experience trying to stop the boat sinking. George Clooney, one of his better movies, I think. And what happened was magichan liyama rabba. These four winds started stirring up the great sea. Doesn't really give us a geographical location. Who knows what he's talking about? All right, it's all coming from the sea. It's all coming from below. What we're basically talking about here, the imagery, is going to be the imagery of the, how should we call it, the nations of the world coming from the earth, coming from below. And you'll see the contrast will be the imagery of Mashiach, of the salvation coming from the from heaven, coming from the sky, coming from Shammai. So there's going to be this kind of balance, or this contrast between what comes out of the great sea, essentially what comes out of the ground, what comes out of the earth, and what is going to be contrasted with whatever comes from heaven. So listen to this, verse 3. V'yaba chevan ravrava. In my image I saw four enormous beasts, right? Animals. Salka minyama came out of the sea. Shanyan damidav, different from one another. Four different images. Now, as I said, this is where it gets weird. Dala. Kadmata ka'aryeh. Excuse me.
The first one was like a lion. And we had the lion image last week because of the lion's den. All right? And of course the lion is the image of Bavel, because that was the whole thing with the lion's den, with Daniel coming from the tribe of Yehuda. So the lion against the lion. You know, I think we spoke a bit about this last week. So the first image that he saw was an image of a lion, v'gapim dinashar lo, but it had the wings of an eagle. Whatever that means, right? So this is where your imagination will get yourself going. There is I don't know who drew pictures of all this stuff. I suppose, you know, you think of sort of Middle Ages. Somebody must have drawn pictures of this. Dante, or not Dante, what's the guy called? The Inferno. Dante's Inferno. Who drew the picture of it? I don't remember who the artist is. I mean, these are fantastic images, and as I said, it just gets very strange. You've got a lion with the wings of an eagle. Chazei chaveit, and this is what I saw. Ad di maritu gape, till the wings were plucked, the wings were taken away. Unatilat min ara, and what happened was it was taken away from the earth. Not exactly sure how. Ba'al raglayin ke'enash hakimot. And it stood, in other words, once the wings were removed, the lion stood like a human being on 2 feet. Ulavav enash yahivla, and it got the heart of enash, of a human being. It's talking here again, say the commentaries say that what happened was that the plucking of the wings is the downfall of Babylon, right? Symbolically represented by that. And once it was removed, it says it got the heart of a mortal, says Rashi, ve'elva v'enash loshen chalashot kumo yedu goyim enosh heima sela, that they became human. What the idea is that the kingdom of Babylon, which thought itself to be so high and mighty, was brought down to the level of human beings. This happens to, it happened to Paro, it happened to all the people who thought they were going, you know, the thousand-year Reich. And in the end of the day, it was destroyed, thank God. And all of these types of images are very powerful images of bringing things down to earth. Everything about the conquest of the nations, the four chayot, the four animals that are being referred to here, are all very earthy. They're all very material, very images which are sort of, you know, sort of very much based in this world. But not based in this world, because they're all fantastic images at the same time. It's very difficult to explain this, but bear with me, because as we go along, I hope it becomes a bit clearer. Hey, va'aru cheva acharet inyan. There was another beast. This refers to the next kingdom, which of course is, as if we're talking about the years of Belshazzar, which means it's still happening, that Babylon is still around. This is already a prophecy that Babylon was going to fall, and a new kingdom was going to come along. Darmia l'dov, which was like a bear. And the rabbis say that the bear represents Persia. All right, the Persians were like bears. There's a whole Gemara about it. All the, not very complimentary, I have to say. V'lishtar chad hakimat. And what happened was, it stood to one side. Utzlati loim bepume bein shinai. Had 3 ribs in its mouth. Now, what does that mean? So the Mefarshim again explained that what was going on here is that Persia was constantly being attacked by 3 different countries. Or it could be referring to 3 different kings who were coming against Persia. All right, there's a whole big discussion of exactly what it means. I forgot now what Rashi says. Just 1 second. Yeah, Talatiloim Bepume. Rashi says Shalosh Salot Rabbeinu Pishu Gimel Medinot Hayu Tamid Mordotba. There were 3 countries always rebelling against Persia. Umashlimot Iman, used to make peace. Sometimes the Persians would swallow them up, sometimes they would spit them out. This is the idea of what it says, the bones are in the mouth. Rashi says, no, maybe this is not actually attacking Persia, but this refers to the 3 kings that are going to come into the Persian Empire, Koresh, Achashverosh, and Daryovish, Shebona Habayit. That in fact, it's not the 3 attacking elements against the Persian kingdom, but it's actually the three kings who are going to lead to the building of the temple. So Rashi brings two options here, what exactly the symbolism is about. All right. So again, you have this image of this bear, which is standing to one side with some sort of bones in its mouth. V'chein amrin lei kumi ichli basar sagi. Right? And they would say to it, go and eat a lot of meat. Okay? Which again, I suppose, is a symbol here. Says Rashi, what is it referring to? Basar harbe. In other words, that this empire of Persia will again go and conquer many places. All right? Because that's the next empire. Vav. Batar dana chazei chaveit. After this, I saw another animal come along. Va'aru achari kinamar. This was like a leopard. Now again, who's he referring to? V'la gapin arba. It had four wings. Di oval gabe, like a bird on its back. A leopard with four bird's wings. All right, we'll look at Rashi in a second. V'arba reishin lechevata. And it had four heads. V'shaltan yoivla. And it was in control. Says Rashi, this is a reference to none other than Alexander the Great. Alexander Mokdon, as he is called in the Gemara. Alexander Macedonian. Look at Rashi, Vav. Gapin arba varba rashin. Heim dalad moshlim. Shechalak lahem Alexandrus Mokdon b'moto. What happened was, when Alexander died, the kingdom broke into four different kingdoms, right? Seleucus and Ptolemy, all the different generals took different parts, north, south. It's the whole Hanukkah story. Everything around Hanukkah is to do with this story. And it says here, this is basically, he quotes from the Sefer Yosef Ben-Gurion, Shehechia Hachaya Zot HaShlishit, the third animal being referred to here, Malchut Antiochus, V'nikra Nameh. Why is this kingdom of Greece called a leopard? Hashem, just reading Rashi, Hashem Shaita Gozerek Gezerot HaYisrael, Menumarot U'meshonot Zunizot, because it made decrees on Israel, which were spotted, were so strange. All right, you know, they forbid them at certain times to do certain mitzvot. Everything that the description here of the leopard is, in terms of Rashi's interpretation, representing the decrees that were made against the Jewish people. According to other people say, the leopard refers to Alexander. His kingdom was so vast and so quick. All right, he conquered the whole world. He was only 32 years old by the time he died. 32 years old, and then he was killed in battle. Okay, if you see the movie Alexander, they made a movie of a few years ago. It's just interesting, the history. How much of the world he conquered. And again...
This week.
Sorry?
I saw the end of it this week.
Yeah. It's a fascinating, again, just to read this stuff and to get some sort of idea of the scale of Alexander's empire. The famous story, of course, that he comes to Yerushalayim, and they're very worried he's going to walk into Jerusalem and destroy it or conquer it. And the Kohen Gadol comes out to meet him, very famous story in the Gemara. And he bows down, he gets down on his knee and bows down to the Kohen Gadol because he saw in a dream that this image was something that he'd already been exposed to. And he became very, respectful to the Jewish religion. Which of course was a big problem because then all Hellenism got going. We became very Hellenistic. That's the whole Hanukkah problem. Alexander the Great, instead of maybe being more antagonistic towards Jerusalem, became sort of complimentary in so many ways. And that, of course, led opened the door for people. You know, Jews always like to sort of indulge in new fads. And in those days, the fad was definitely Hellenism. It was very popular. So we're coming up to Hanukkah, so there's a bit of a relevance to that. Sorry?
By calendar with Shtaros and everything.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I
mean, that there is a very... I think there's a kind of an ambiguity about Greek culture and Greek in general, because it's considered to be a beautiful language. And there are many references in the Gemara which are very positive. And then the Gemara, the different rabbis would say, Chochma Yevanit. Greek wisdom is something that you should not indulge in. Acher, right? The famous Elisha ben Avoya. They say, why did he go off the rails? Because his pockets were full of Greek books. He read all of this stuff. So there is a kind of difference between different rabbis as to how to handle, you know, secular studies. That gets into a whole discussion of another nature. Back to this. Listen to this. This is really weird. Zayt. What happened after this particular animal disappeared? Batar dana, after this, He says, "Chazei havei bechezvelar." Again, I was looking at this image of the night. Va'aruch chevar rivi. I saw a fourth animal, which was techilo, which was frightening. Ve'imtane v'takifa yatir, extremely frightening, right? Extremely strong. V'shinayan di parzalai, had iron teeth. This again is a reference to Rome, the Roman Empire. Ravravan, it was extremely strong. Ochla umadka, he would eat and trample shaara baraglai rafsa with its feet. In other words, basically the Romans just, you know, trampled every country that they went into. This image, this animal was different to all the other animals that came before it. Vekarnin asarle, and it had 10 horns. Wow, now what is going on here is really, really weird. What I, again, want to sort of just refer you to here is this, the thing about the 10 horns. He brings here, the Reb Sadia Gaon, in the comments here, that one of the kingdoms that is being referred to here is not even the Roman kingdom. He wants to say this is actually the kingdom of Ishmael. These are the Arabs, and he says the 10 horns refer to 10 individual kingdoms which are governed by its own monarch. All right, so there's one interpretation here that this is not even the kingdom of Rome. This is actually the Arab world, which is the fourth and final and most frightening kingdom of all of the future predictions of what's going to come about. And that's, again, gives you a bit of a pucker when you think today what's going on in the world. That if it's referring to the Arabs, this is really quite scary. Melbourne doesn't agree. Melbourne says it refers to Rome. That eventually Rome was divided into 10 different kingdoms. As we know, the Roman Empire split and split again until eventually it disappeared, as the history goes. But the number 10 is kind of interesting here. As we'll see, there is this 10, the reference to the keren, the horn which is on the head of this animal. Right. I'll just read this in a second. Let's look at verse 8. It just gets more fantastic as we go along. Chet mistakal haveit bekarnai. I was looking at these horns of this animal. The elu keren acharei zeira silka benel. And I saw there was a little small horn amongst those horns. Utalat min karnaya kadmiyata. Right. And there were the first three horns were there, it's akarum in kadamai, were removed, were plucked. The elu einin keinei anoshin, had eyes like human eyes, bekarna do, right, with this horn, upum male ravravan, and it was speaking arrogantly. The Gemara talks about this. Gemara says this is a reference to the Roman general who destroyed the temple, Titus. What did he do? He walked into the Holy of Holies, he took with him a zonah, a harlot, committed a sin there and spoke against God, and he took a sword and he put a sword into the parochet and blood came out. All right, and there's a whole discussion of the rabbis there, what exactly happened. But Titus was very full of his own arrogance. So there's no question that if it's referring to the Romans, it fits very well into the image that we have of a tremendous arrogance of that group of people. So this is Daniel talking about events which are happening way, way in the future. Right, this is well over, certainly sort of between 500 and 1,000 years on. There is even a suggestion here, if I'm not mistaken, if it comes up. Yeah, this is really weird. I don't know where this comes from. Oh, it's in the Malbim. The suggestion of the human eyes. Right, it says that in verse 8, this animal had ene anosha. The eyes were human. It was a mouth that spoke arrogantly with human eyes. So let me read this note to you. If you have the red book, you can read it here on page 65. This probably refers to Muhammad. Whoa. It's a reference to Islam. Rambam says in Ngeret Teiman that this is a reference to a person who pretends to be a prophet. Got to be careful saying this stuff, especially in this day and age. Got to be politically correct. You know, we have a president who worries about these things. And asserts that God spoke to him and revealed to him a book. This obviously refers to Muhammad. And the innovation of Islam is embodied in the Quran. Malbin follows the Barbanel that the small horn is the Pope in Rome. Another suggestion. Beginning of the papacy, he says, which was initially small and insignificant, and the 10 horns are the emperors that ruled the Roman Empire, all of whom degraded Christianity. Then the horn This little horn gained power during the rule of Constantine, around the year 320 of the Common Era. And he took Sylvester the Pope, if you know all this history, he was hiding in a cave, brought him to Rome, and gave him the crown of the empire for himself and a successor to rule in Rome and Italy. Constantine went to Constantinople and built it up. You had the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire, all right? And we know all this history, and established the capital of the Eastern Empire. Malbim conjectures that the three horns that were plucked out are the three kings of Rome, destined to break away from the rule of the Pope. How interesting. He does not elaborate on this, but writes that if one seeks this, one will find three mighty kings who seceded from the Catholic Church several hundred years before the Malbims' time. One of whom happens to be, obviously, the Reformation in England. I'm sure there's a reference to, was it Henry VIII who got away because of his, he had some problems with the wives. Couldn't divorce them. Yeah, so, you know, so that's maybe one of the kings that's being referred to. This is fascinating. All of a sudden, we've jumped from a biblical book into medieval history, maybe even beyond, all right? With all of these references, as strange as the references are, to events which, you know, come together here, either references to Islam, references to the Catholic Church, or whatever, whichever you want to refer to it, unbelievable here, yeah. Yeah, that would have been a lot simpler. But the reality of it is that because it's so obscure, it helps us to become more poetic in our interpretation. You know, it gives them a fresher and easier time to put whatever they want to read into this, they can read into it. I mean, the fact that Rambam here refers to Islam as being the false prophet and everything else, you've got to be careful to say such a thing. So the Rambam wrote this in the Gerit Teiman. I assume the Rambam wrote this, I don't know, when he was living. Where would he be living? He'd be living somewhere where he wouldn't be in great danger. You know, sometimes you have to be careful what you wrote. Especially in those days, you know, that people would read this and they would start... his life would be in danger for writing things. So, again, I'm not sure about the actual writing of this, where he wrote it, where he was at the time. It's very fascinating, yeah. And he was in Egypt. You pluck it from the air, correct. Obviously, what they're all seeing is, people like Abarbanel is seeing the Catholic Church as public enemy number one, for lots of very obvious reasons. Rambam is seeing the rise of Islam as being detrimental to the world, you know, even in those days, right, with everything that was going on, and today even more so. So the reality of it is that, you know, they are interpreting this very obscure image in ways which fit into what the image is trying to represent for them in their particular world. So, for instance, you know, Malbim will sort of later on maybe make references to the latter developments of the Catholic Church and how things have sort of moved away from traditional Christianity and gone into other directions. You know, all of this history which the Mefarshim are reading into it reflect the commentators' own situation historically speaking. Now, what the modern day guys will say about all of this, I don't know. It's interesting, yeah. Yeah.
So in the next passage, it talks about the white garment, and it talks about the wheels of fire.
Yeah.
And putting that together, you can say, well, that's the oil wells, and that's the sound.
And then you want to make a reference to the oil. You can see this in terms of maybe the Catholic Church and the Inquisition. I don't know. That's also another image that comes to mind. It's very, very open here, but the power of it is that if you see all of this here, you realize what Daniel is saying, that all of these great empires will eventually be brought to task. And that's what is the most shocking of all of this, is that people read this book, and I know Christian theologians dwell on the book of Daniel a lot, right? Because he talks about Mashiach and they like that side of things, but they don't dwell on this side of things too much, because it's basically saying that if you take all the different commentaries here, what it's referring to, there's a lot of din v'cheshbon, there's a lot of answering that they have to make, and I'll just leave it at that, but I think it's clear what exactly the consequence of it is, but the imagery is really quite extraordinary. Tet, let's see if we can get through to the end of the chapter. It's just literally trying to sort of struggle through these images. Chose haveit adi kosavan remit. So he says, I was looking upon thrones, va'atik yomin yasib, and I saw a throne on which the Ancient One of Days. In other words, he's now referring to the contrast to the animals. The Chayot, I'm going to look and see an image coming from heaven of Atik Yomin, something which is very old. Levushei Kitalag Chivav, wearing this white, it was white like snow, his garment. Usar Reshei Kamar Nekeh, and his hair was like clean wool. Karseya Shevivin Dinur, surrounded by sparks of fire around his throne. Galgaloi Nur Dalek, and the wheels were like a burning fire. Again, this image is in contrast, and it's referring to Mashiach, if I'm not mistaken. It doesn't say, Rashi doesn't bring this, but he brings this here from other commentaries, that this is a messianic image which he is talking about here. The idea of the burning fire, a reference to the Merkava, this is an image which is found in other places, the fiery chariot of God, whatever that means. It's wild. Yud, the Har Dinur, and there is a river of fire, Naged v'nafek min kodamoi, which comes before him, Elef alpaim yisham shune. There are thousands upon thousands of servants, right, referring to the angels. Ribo rivan kadamoi gikuman, and these thousands and tens of thousands stand before him. Dino yativ v'sifrim p'tichu. The books are open and judgment is taking place. In other words, all of those animals that we saw before representing the different kingdoms are all being judged. Yudalem. Chosei aveit ba'adayim min kol milaya ravravosa. And I saw from the sounds of the arrogance, the karna mamalalov, that horn that was speaking, and especially if he's referring to the Pope, then he's really having a go at Christianity here. Chazei haveit adi ketilat chevota v'uvad gishme. I saw that the beast was slain and the body was destroyed. V'yehivas the kedad esha was put into fire. And eventually that kingdom will be destroyed. Ushar chevota hediv. And the other beasts, their rulership was removed. The arke b'chayin yehivad lahon ad zman v'idan, and they were given an extension, he says, for a set time. This is where it gets very obscure, because not exactly sure what he's referring to here, you know, in terms of these different kingdoms, what exactly the extension means. He says that although they will be put aside, they will come back again. So of course there is the Mefarshim here talk about Gog and Magog, this image that is in the book of Yechezkel, the idea of the war of wars which would happen at the end of time. I don't know, this is already getting into territory which I can't really explain. Yud Gimel. Chazei haveit b'chezvel, and again I was looking at night time, v'aroyim adonai shemayin, I saw these heavenly clouds, kabar enash atei hava, I saw a person coming. This is where the Christians get very excited, but for us it's a reference to Mashiach. The Ad Atik Yomaya Mata, he got to the Atik Yomaya, referring to God. He joined God in this heavenly image, the Kodomoi Hakrivui, and was brought before him. And what did he do? The Lei Yahav Shaltam V'Yikio Malchut. He was given kingship and honor and malchut and dominion. V'Chol Amamaya Umaya V'Lishanaya, all of the nations and the tongues. Lei Yiflechum will worship him. Shaltone Shaltan Alam. His kingdom is forever. Dilo Yedei, which will never be removed. Umalchusei Dilo Tidchabal, and his kingdom will never be destroyed. So this is again a messianic prophecy that after all of this judgment and everything that takes place, that will be the time for Mashiach. And of course, again, the Mefarshim go into all the different images here in terms of where Mashiach will come, in terms of Be'ita Chishena, this famous discussion. There can be two times for Mashiach. Be'ita means at its time, when it's meant to come. And Achishana means you can hasten it. You can make it come quicker. And this is the we want Mashiach now concept, right? That we can bring it about in a quicker way. The messianism and everything else that goes with it. Got to be careful with messianism. Without getting too involved in different groups that have had problems with it, the reality of it is, it's always been very challenging for the Jewish people. And again, you know, one knows what the problems are today, but go back to Shabtai Tzvi and you'll see what a disaster it was 300 years ago when all of a sudden the Jews started getting messianic. It's sometimes, you know, you do it because of troubles and whatever, but the consequence of it was terrible. The European Jewish community was split for a very long time over this whole thing, long after Shabtai Tzvi was dead. Tedvah. excuse me, Eskrias Ruche Ana Daniel Bena Bego Nidne, whatever that is. He says, I was very worried, says Daniel. V'chezvei Rosh Yivalunim, I got a headache. You know, as I saw all this, I was tittering, I was trembling. Okay, this is a bad nightmare, if you think about it. Kirveit Al-Chad Min Kamamaya. And I got near to whoever was standing there. Obviously, this Atik Yomim, whatever that is. V'yatsiva Evei Minei Al-Koldin. I asked one of the angels to explain to me what's going on. V'amarli P'sham Ilai Yodin. He told me the whole explanation. And this is what it is. Elaine Chevata Revata, these large animals, Dinun Arba, which were four of them, Arba Malchin Yikumin Ara, this is referring to four kings, kingdoms that will come up from the earth. Alright, so this is an explanation of what we just saw. V'yikablun Malchuta Kadisha Elyon, and eventually they will receive the most holy kingdom, they will accept upon themselves the kingdom of holies, of holiness, V'yachsunun Malchute Ad Alma, V'ad olam omay, and the kingdom will last forever. Adayin savit yatzava al chevata riviyata. I'm still wanting to find out about the fourth animal, which was so different. Dihavat shanya min kulam, which was so different to all of them. Dechila yatira was so frightening. Shinaya diparza, they had these iron teeth. But tafrafe dinachash, and nails made out of copper. Achle matko sh'ara beraglai rafsa, and it was treading and destroying everything in its wake. Al karnaya sad dibresha, and the ten horns in his head. V'achri di salikas and afela min kadamaya talat, and three of them had fallen down. V'karna dichein ve'enin lo, and it had these eyes which were human eyes. U'puma male ravan, and it spoke all of this arrogance. V'chezva rav min chavreta, and seemed to be greater, seemed to be larger than all the other animals. Chazei haveit v'karna dichein. Of the karavim kadishim v'yochlin lahon, and I saw that the animal or the horn was making war, right, with the holy ones and overcome them. And again, if you say it refers to the Pope, it's really the sort of Christianity conquering the world as it did for so many hundreds of years. Ad di ata atik yomai, until eventually the ancient one of days, referring to God, would come. V'dino yahiv lekadisha elyonim, and gave revenge, it says here in the translation, to these holy ones. V'zimna matar malchuta echsinu kadishin, and they inherited the malchut of the kingdom. In other words, eventually it was overcome. Kein amar chevata reviyata. This is so strange. So the fourth animal, he said, what does it represent? Malchut reviyata hevibar is going to be a fourth kingdom. The Tiskeb min kol machvosa is going to be larger than all the others. If this refers to Yishmael, it's really frightening. But Techul kol ara will consume the whole land. Uta dushine uvetadkine, and will trample and crush it. The karnaya asar mina malchuta, and the ten horns that come from this kingdom, asara malchin yukuma, will refer to ten kings, kingdoms. Vachron yukum achrein, and then there'll be the last one. For who yisgei min kadamaya, he will be even stronger than all the rest of them. The rabbis say, if it's Rome, it's referring to the end of the Roman Empire, the different Caesars, or rather the Caesars who were still very strong. Some say it's a reference to Titus again. Utalata malchin yahashbil, and there are going to be three kingdoms in the end which are going to be humble. Very obscure what exactly he's referring to. Kafe umilin letzadi loy yamalel kadisha elyonin yivala. He'll speak words against the Most High. Again, if it's Titus, it's his speech as recorded in the Gemara against God, and he will say things against the Holy One. He'll try to change the times and the religion. And he will be handed over to the and this is the reference to the Messianic era. It's going to be a time and a time and half a time. Idan v'idanan v'plag idan. Translated literally means time, two times and half a time. And this is where, if you have the English translation here, you can see he comes out, not quite sure he gets to this number. Rashi works it out here, Gematria, and it turns out it's 1,336 years. From the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, he works out a number here to get to 1,336 years after the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, which is around the 1400s, all right? That would be the time at which, he says, this is when this reckoning will take place. Now again, is this an actual time? He says, accordingly, the Messiah should have come in the year 1497. That's the year that's being referred to here. But it wasn't. 1497 was 5 years after the exile of the Jews from Spain. It was really not a messianic time. I suppose you can say discovering America, that was messianic, but you can sort of discuss that in your own time. Sorry? This is again brought in the commentary here from Rashi. He brings this from Seder Dorot, based on Rashi in Gemara. Rashi not here, but Rashi is in Talmud of Avodah Zarah. So it's fascinating. I mean, the speculation here is incredible. And because it is so speculative, that's what makes it interesting and kind of difficult, because what can we really say about
this?
Is
where the Arabs get their
strength? Maybe, I don't know. I don't know if they have such a tradition. I don't know. It's fascinating.
They had something.
Yeah. And if they do, then maybe this is where it comes from. I don't know.
And Rashi also, it's interesting and ironic that he's stating that he didn't dream this all animals in one night.
Yeah.
He said that the tree was in one night.
And then the other one. It's not such an animal. It's got human eyes, and that's what's so scary. You know, they're talking about Nebuch, this poor guy that got executed, was murdered by them. They're trying to identify the executioner. He's got a British accent, and by his eyes. Right? You know, I was thinking about that when I was reading this. The human eyes, but everything else about him is Behema, Chaya. Right? You know, Pera Adam. Wild. I mean, how evil you must be to do that and to film it on top of it. It's disgusting. Who wrote it? Again, the suggestion is, although it was Daniel experienced it, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, beginning of the second Bayit.
My question is, what was the point of putting all this in? It's like so nebulous, so, you know, you could put a million things into it. What's the benefit of it? Why do they do it?
I suppose you have to say, because of the knowledge of way, the way Jewish history is going to go, it gives people, again, it's all part of the Emunah thing. It's saying that in the end there will be reckoning. There will be din v'cheshbon. Somebody will have to give an account of what they do, of their negative behavior towards Am Yisrael. Because at the end of the day, they're all, you know, treading on nations around the world, and particularly Am Yisrael is suffering. So the suggestion, I suppose, is that all of this is here to kind of give the Jews in exile the sense of hatikva. You know, there's some hope. Something in the end will be done, but it's so obscure, and that's why people don't learn this, because you know you come out of this probably more tzimish than when you went in. On the other hand, it's so fascinating. The references to Islam, the references to Christianity is fascinating. They're reading into it, of course, but just by doing that, it's fascinating. Sorry.
You keep saying it's going to happen in this year, in this year, in this year, and it doesn't happen. So
we lose out. That's the point, and that's why the Mefarshim are very careful here to say, in the end, it's when it happens, it happens. Bi'ita achishana. I can make it come quickly, but there is a time, but that is so obscure of it, we don't really know what it is. It doesn't give you a date. It gives you hints that you can start thinking about dates, but it doesn't give you a date. But what an interesting chapter. Yeah, and the Malbim does. He tries to pin it down, right? But again, I suppose everybody in his or own sort of time frame were looking for the ultimate sort of day of redemption. I mean, you know, this is a Hakala B'choyim Sheyova. So it's just putting that into practice. People got very excited about this, but at the same time, it's so, you know, obscure the way it's presented. Who can really come out with anything here?
The other thing is, fascinating. I don't know about you, but when you dream, 10 seconds later, you forget.
You forget. No, this obviously made an impression on him. You know, he was so freaked out by these dreams.
He didn't even write it. He actually says it.
Yeah, I mean, he made Rosh Milin, you know, he sort of wrote down he wrote the bullets. Yeah, I mean, this, anyone has, I hope you don't go home and dream this tonight, you know, just don't take this to heart too much. All right, we're already out of time. Let's just finish the chapter because we're almost done. Kavam, v'dina yativ, v'shaltoni yitadun, v'shmoda lo'evoda ad sofa. This will be a destruction of the enemy. At the end, v'malchuta v'shaltona revuta di machvot, t'chol kol shema, and all the kingdoms under the heaven. Yehovet la'am kadisha leona, will give honor to those of the holy ones. Malchusei malchuta olam, his kingdom is forever. V'chol shaltona le'yifichun nishtamun, they will bow down to him, they will listen to him. At Kos Sofati Milta, this was the end of the matter. Anah Daniel, and Daniel sort of signs on the dotted line here. I, Daniel, Sagiv, Rayone, Yivaluni, all of these thoughts confuse me, confuse everybody. My color changed. I went very pale because I saw all of this. Umilta Belibi Nitrate, but I guarded it in my heart. Right? We say with Yaakov Avinu, Aviv Shamar Tadava. Right? Remember what it says. Yaakov, he knew something was going on when Yosef was, the whole story, so he kept it in his heart. He knew that there was something in the future. He didn't believe, you know, that Yosef had been killed. And here Daniel also says, whatever this dream eventually turns out to be, Belibi Nitrate, I guard it in my heart because I know something will come about.
You got it. You understood it.
Yeah. But what do we make of this? I really don't know. All I can say is that the next one is equally as mysterious. It goes on like this for a few chapters. We'll see. We might condense maybe one or two of the chapters because this is just mind-blowing, you know, and it gets a bit too much. There is the Tefillah of Daniel, which comes up here as well, which is really very beautiful. So, Bezrat Hashem, there's still more to go. But as I said, how different this section of the book is from what we've been learning till now. But, wow. It's just amazing what he's referring to here. To be continued. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.